Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Federal judge denies injunction request to stop new assault weapons ban in Washington. Pullman Council hears consultants' housing plan, who say the city needs 10,000 more units by the year 2040. And Idaho employers say in survey, employee retention among their top concerns. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Federal District Court Judge Robert Bryan in Tacoma denied a request for a preliminary injunction yesterday to block Washington's new semi-automatic rifle law, which bans the sale, distribution, and importation of the guns referred to as assault weapons. Owners of the guns could still keep them under House Bill 1240, which Governor Jay Inslee signed last month. Gun groups had sued, asking the court to stop the law from going into effect, saying it violates the Second Amendment. In his 14-page order, Judge Bryan implied the plaintiffs would not likely be successful if the case moved forward. According to the Washington State Standard, the judge wrote, "Considering the exceptional dangerousness of these weapons, the public interest in their regulation by the state outweighs the plaintiff's desire to purchase more assault weapons. In light of recent mass deaths caused by assailants using assault weapons, it is appropriate for governmental bodies to find ways to protect the public from dangerous weapons within the limits of the Second Amendment." In a controversial ruling last year, the Trump Supreme Court claimed state gun laws must be consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation if they are to be constitutional. Lawyers for the Office of Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson argued in court that there are a range of restrictions on weapons that authorities say are too dangerous, including laws limiting certain types of clubs, knives, and machine guns. Judge Bryan noted the previous laws in his ruling, writing, "Each of the above arms restrictions, including bans and restrictions on carrying, arose from the same historical pattern. The weapon was invented, perhaps for the military, became widely popular with civilians, was associated with criminal use, and then was regulated by the states. House Bill 1240's prohibition on the manufacture, import, and sale of semi-automatic assault weapons responds to the same pattern, technological weapons change, that sets forth unprecedented social concerns." Attorney General Ferguson issued a statement yesterday which said, "We remain undefeated against the gun lobby in court. This common-sense gun reform will save lives by restricting access to the preferred weapon of mass shooters." The plaintiffs included the Second Amendment Foundation, the Firearms Policy Coalition, and a Vancouver gun store. Second Amendment Foundation Executive Director Adam Kraut wrote in an email after yesterday's ruling, "Of course, because the law has not been enjoined, it prevents Washingtonians from being able to fully exercise their right to keep and bear arms. We are currently reviewing our legal options." The group Every Town for Gun Safety says Washington is one of 10 states that have passed prohibitions on semi-automatic rifles. Pasco has become the first of the Tri-Cities in Central Washington to lift their ban on cannabis retail. The Pasco City Council voted 4-3 Monday to make zoning changes that will allow the sale of cannabis in 3 commercial zones and 3 industrial zones. A recently created 6-block buffer reduction area will also allow 1 retail cannabis store in downtown Pasco. The Tri-City Herald reports 3 businesses are looking to open cannabis retail stores in the city. The Washington Liquor and Cannabis Board has limited Pasco to 4 cannabis stores based on the city's population, and at least 1 of the stores would have to be held by a social equity licensee. Cannabis stores cannot open within 1,000 feet of a school, playground, recreation center, child care center, public park, public transit center, library, or all ages gaming arcade. Pasco city officials estimate the city could receive $200,000 annually in revenue through the state's 37% excise tax on cannabis. The media coalition in the murder case of suspect Brian Koberger says the gag order Magistrate Judge Megan Marshall signed in January is the cause of a vacuum of rampant speculation online. Judge Marshall's gag order prevents attorneys, law enforcement, and those involved in the case from speaking publicly about it. The coalition's argument asserts the order is a violation of the First Amendment. Judge Marshall and defense attorneys argue the gag order is necessary to protect Brian Koberger's right to a fair trial. Law enforcement is holding 28-year-old Brian Koberger at the Layton County Jail. Koberger faces four counts of first-degree murder and a burglary charge over the stabbing deaths of University of Idaho students Kaylee Goncalves, Madison Mogan, Zana Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin, who were found dead of knife wounds in an off-campus house in November. According to the Daily News, Layton County District Judge John Judge will hear arguments tomorrow from the media coalition, who will ask him to vacate Marshall's gag order. Judge will also allow arguments from Goncalves family attorney Shannon Gray, who seeks to have the gag order amended to permit him to speak publicly on behalf of his clients. In a recently released memorandum from two media coalition lawyers, Wendy Olson and Corey Carone, says they agree with Gray. The attorneys say they want the judge to balance Koberger's Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial and First Amendment rights to free speech. Olson and Carone argue Koberger's lawyers and the Layton County Prosecutor's Office submitted no evidence to support their rationale when Marshall created the gag order. They said Koberger's attorney should not be allowed to ambush the media coalition with evidence which should have been disclosed at that time. According to the memorandum, the state's and Mr. Koberger's failure to present any evidence of prejudicial news coverage and the court's failure to consider alternative measures means the competing constitutional rights here were improperly balanced and the gag order should be vacated. If anything, the gag order prejudices Mr. Koberger by depriving the public of quality information, creating a vacuum for rampant speculation online. The judge in the case has set a Tuesday, June 27th court date to consider Koberger's request to release grand jury proceedings, which also includes transcripts and a list of prospective jurors. Many Idaho employers say their top worry is worker turnover. Department of Labor Statistics survey results show the largest gaps in employee skill sets are what are known as soft skills. Department of Labor officials hosted a webinar yesterday showing some results from the Labor Department's Idaho Employer Climate Survey, which was conducted in March. Labor Department research analyst Craig Schall said they conducted the survey asking people about remote work, how they feel about the current economic climate, and other information not included by other national sources. Schall said, as everyone knows, we've been going through a kind of turning point in the labor market. There's lots of changes that's been happening, especially after the pandemic. Idaho Labor Department economist Matt Paskesh said 31% of survey respondents said their main concern is the high employee turnover rates, and 22% say supply or cost of workers is their next concern. Paskesh said, with ChatGPT and other AI applications coming out, a lot of talk about how much they're going to be displacing workers and very disruptive to the industry is going on. We still need flesh and blood people showing up in some capacity to do certain tasks, which simply cannot be automated anytime soon. Labor is still a very necessary input to the economy, and that's being reflected here. According to survey results, the primary reason of the high turnover rates is 25% of workers are leaving their current positions for a different job, and 19% are going to a different employer for a similar job. Retiring workers accounted for 14% of employees leaving their jobs. 85% of respondents report their employees decided on their own to leave their jobs. 10.7% of the survey's respondents left their jobs because their bosses discharged or terminated them. Pashkash said the results are not surprising given the tightness of the labor market. Pashkash said, what we're mostly seeing right now is just the churn of workers trying to find the best match for them in terms of work arrangements, compensation, so on and so forth. According to the survey, when asked which skills should increase over the next 5 years, employers said managerial and supervisory skills topped the list, with time management, teamwork, and work ethics closely following. They also said basic computer skills were important. Pashkash said the Department of Labor will release more information on the survey in July. He said, what we're giving is perhaps just a sliver of a much larger pie, so to speak, of what we found in the survey. The department has scheduled a second webinar on the subject for Tuesday, July 11th.
Programming on KRFP is supported in part by Idaho AFL-CIO, dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and local level.
KRFP is also sponsored by the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at PalouseFolk.org or on Facebook.
The Pullman City Council last night learned by 2040, Pullman will need 10,000 more housing units. Consultants with SCJ Alliance of Spokane presented a draft Pullman housing plan to the council. Lauren Schubring and Mike Manning of SCJ Alliance drew up the action plan for Pullman using a $25,000 grant from the State Department of Commerce. The two outlined seven strategies the city should follow.
So strategy one is to update zoning and development regulations, some of those recommended actions. And you'll see in the full plan that they're broken down more and provide examples from different communities or some more specific actions that can be taken. But the first one is to strategically rezone areas to increase and diversify housing options, and then to expand the use of middle housing types into all residential zones, C1 and C2. So you'll see in that image that's provided just some examples of some middle housing types, and that can be useful to kind of help visualize. And then in that same strategy, some more actions are to adjust lot size minimums and permitted densities in residential zones. And the image on the right there, kind of shows an example of that, because sometimes it can be difficult to imagine what 12 or 18 units per acre might actually look like. But you can see, even as an example, I like that one where in the same lot size, if you have those 8 units, but then they each have an ADU, all of a sudden you're adding a lot more capacity on the same area of land. And then lastly, combine and simplify off-street parking requirements.
Okay, and going into strategy two and those associated actions, strategy two is to build partnerships to facilitate affordable housing. So what those actions are going to look like is to develop a housing committee made up of local housing stakeholders, to explore multifamily tax exemption programs for affordable housing, create development agreement standards to promote housing with provisions requiring a percentage of affordable housing and community benefits, collaborate with nonprofit organizations on temporary housing and permanent supportive housing, and to work closely with the Washington State University on student housing options.
Strategy three in the plan is some of the Well, it's to dedicate city resources, and what that might look like is to make strategic investments in infrastructure, to dedicate staff resources to housing coordination, to develop an ADU program. An ADU, if you're unfamiliar, is an accessory dwelling unit, and that figure on the right shows an example of either an internal ADU or an attached ADU or a detached ADU, which is, you know, sometimes these are known as mother-in-law suites or other terms that are similar to that. Provide incentives specifically for ADUs, cottage housing / backyard cottages, and senior housing, and to pursue funding opportunities.
So what strategy four looks to do is to encourage the maintenance of existing housing stock. And some actions to help ensure that is to incentivize homeowners and landlords to improve the quality and maintenance of that housing, and then utilize code enforcement as necessary to ensure quality of housing.
So strategy five is to minimize displacement, which of course is really important as any community is growing, to make sure that you're looking out for, well, really any residents of the community, but or anybody who's living in Pullman, but also, you know, as communities, you never want your long-term residents to be pushed out of your community. So some actions to help minimize displacement are to ensure housing options remain affordable amongst new developments, support aging-in-place services, and to address the needs of those struggling with housing stability and are at risk of homelessness or displacement.
Okay, and what strategy six looks to establish is tools and programs to preserve and enhance housing and community character. And what those actions will look like is to assess specific housing types unique to each of the neighborhood hills and address those through zoning and development standards. Offer density bonuses for ADUs, those accessory dwelling units, to increase lot coverage maximums. And engage developers to provide design standard guidance to streamline permitting and review processes.
That was Mike Manning of SCJ Alliance speaking to the Pullman City Council last night. You also heard from Lauren Schubring of SCJ Alliance. Councilmember Megan Guido said she wants a plan that highlights the needs of renters in Pullman who are not always students.
And it's really hard to say one particular strategy is going to address the fact that we don't have a lot of home health people. You know, it's very systemic, and we recognize that this is, to me, more of a housing assessment and almost suggestion plan. It's not going to solve things overnight. This is a systemic issue. It's happened over years and years and years. So what I found interesting, even more than the suggestions, were just some of the demographic that I think folks don't even really realize that over two-thirds of our households are renters. I think people have, you know, a basic understanding that they're in Pullman and that there are a lot of renters. And we need to be looking at renters along with homeowners with same regard. And renters have rights as well. And we need to be looking at how we can provide housing for folks who want to be homeowners. And then not everybody chooses to be a homeowner. I would like to see more creative work in partnering with people. What I am hearing from seniors in particular is they want to stay in Pullman, but they want to be around other generations, younger generations, and they're saying, why can't we have those kinds of homes where I am with younger people as I'm aging and providing value to our community? We can get creative on this, and we can start doing that.
That was Pullman City Councilmember Megan Guido speaking at last night's council meeting. The Pullman City Council last night voted unanimously in favor of an update of the Shoreline Master Program for the city. State law requires cities to update their shoreline master plans every 8 years, and the Ecology Department had given Pullman until June 30th to update their plan. The agenda said there are no proposed changes to shoreline designations or uses as part of this periodic update. Community Development Director R.J. Lott explained the item to the council last night.
The Shoreline Master Program falls under the umbrella of the State Department of Ecology. They contacted us late last year with a grant and suggested that we form a coalition with Whitman County and other jurisdictions within the county. This is the same process that we did back in 2016, that those of you that can remember. So what this does is it's merely a regulatory update of our Shoreline Master Program. I want to highlight that this will not change any of the shoreline jurisdictions along the South Fork, nor will it change any of the uses allowed. By reference, community development gets about 2 to 3 shoreline permits a year, so not a high number, but still large enough that we need to keep up to date. So the Planning Commission did hear from our consultant that took over the project. They came before the Planning Commission on November 16th, 2022, April 26, 2023, and then did have a public hearing last month on May 24th. So as you can tell, this has been in the works for a number of months.
Pullman Community Development Director R.J. Lott. The Community Development Department reports it grants about 2 or 3 shoreline permits per year.
The Bureau of Land Management has announced a $161 million investment in wildlife habitat projects in 11 western states, and Montana is getting the largest share of all. Montana is set to receive close to $27 million for wildlife habitat, clean water, and restoration projects on public land. The BLM has set aside just over $9 million for the Upper Salmon River, $9.5 million for the Blackfoot-Clark Fork, and almost $7 million for the Highline Sagebrush Anchor. They're all areas in need of critical habitat restoration, says Joel Webster with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership.
This $27 million is going to protect communities from wildfire. It's going to improve rangeland conditions, not only for wildlife, but also for local grazers and livestock producers. It's going to help put people to work. It's a win-win.
The BLM is investing more than $2 billion to restore public lands and waters across the United States, with an eye toward meeting conservation goals established in the America the Beautiful initiative. While the ecological and habitat restoration projects are critically important for Montana, Webster says the investments will bolster economic conditions and recreational opportunities for residents and tourists, too.
It's important for mule deer and pronghorn, and doing restoration work out there is going to help make sure that land remains productive and that, you know, people continue to make a living out there, but also that we have, you know, great hunting opportunities on that landscape as well.
At nearly $27 million, Montana received the largest share of habitat restoration money of the 11 western states that received BLM awards. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Mark Moran.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for parts of Idaho County until midnight tonight. Those areas include Grangeville, U.S. Highway 95, from Riggins to Whitebird, Shep Ranch, Indian Creek, McKay Bar, China Bar near the Salmon River, the Salmon River Road near Moose Creek Fireburn area, and the Williams Creek Fireburn area near Ora Grande. Those are areas that could be affected by flash flooding tonight. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for portions of northern and eastern Washington. The counties affected by the flood watch, which will be in effect from 11 a.m. Thursday until 11 p.m. Friday, until 11 a.m. Friday, include Benoit, Bonner, Boundary, Kootenai, Latah, Lewis, Nez Perce, and Shoshone counties in Idaho, and Chelan, Ferry, Okanagan, Ponderay, Spokane, and Stevens counties in Washington. Flash flooding caused by excessive rainfall is possible. Flooding may occur in poor drainage and urban areas. Extensive street flooding and flooding of creeks and rivers is possible. Thunderstorms will first impact the central Idaho panhandle early Thursday and transition to heavy torrential rainfall by mid to late Thursday in northeastern and north central Washington. Burn scars and steep terrain will be susceptible to flash flooding. Urban and rural areas may experience flooding in low-lying areas and roadways. The threat for flooding will continue overnight into Friday. People should monitor later forecasts and be prepared to take action should flash flood warnings be issued. The forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight tonight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 60. A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the morning tomorrow, with a 70% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm in the afternoon tomorrow. Some storms could produce heavy rain, mostly cloudy, high 81. New rainfall up to a quarter inch, except higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. 60% chance of precipitation Thursday night, showers likely and possibly a thunderstorm. Some storms could produce heavy rain, mostly cloudy, low 58, between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible. On Friday, 60% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm. Some storms could produce heavy rain, otherwise mostly cloudy, high 76. And 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms Friday night, mainly before midnight, mostly cloudy, low 54. And a 30% chance of showers Saturday, mainly in the afternoon, partly sunny, high 77. Currently 86. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. You can also go to the KRFP website where you can find more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. There, you can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option, and there's a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Coming up next, we have Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. Lockdown Mosh Pits on 7:30 to 8:30. At 8:30, music begins in earnest with Grateful Dead Through the Decades, hosted by Arlene. And we'll have What's the Frequency, Kenneth, our weekly musical, which has moved from 7:30. It's now on at 10 p.m. at night. Bob Slack on Funhouse at 11. Thanks for tuning in. KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Fiddler's Ridge Farm, a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving the Palouse since 1992. Two locations to serve you. 2730 Highway 95 South in Moscow and 1001 Fiddler's Ridge Loop in Potlatch. 208-875-1003.